We are going to call this meeting of the House Fisheries Committee to order. The time is 11:03 a.m. And just wanting to get started because we'll need the full amount of time today. So members present at this time, Representative Vance, Representative Story, Representative McCabe, Representative Price Tompkins, Representative Ortiz, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to do business. If we could please ask members to silence our cell phones. If you need to pass a note, please get the attention of the committee aide, Thatcher Brower. Like to extend our thanks to Shannon McCain, our committee secretary, and Alex Banizak from the June LIO for their support. And we're still doing the remote recording, so we ask folks to identify themselves as they speak. One housekeeping item as we get started, we've talked about switching three bills that are currently personal bills to committee bills, and a couple of them because Speaker Stutes does not have the time to work on them, and one of them that I've been working on, but hoping it's something we're all able to work on together. And so we've all talked about it, and everybody has been okay with that. So Representative Ortiz, if I could ask you for the motion.
Madam Chair, I move that House Fisheries Committee become the prime sponsor of HB 26, the Conflict of Interest Board of Fisheries and Board of Fisheries and Game, and then HB 28, Registration of Boats, Exemptions, and HB 54, Invasive Species Management.
Thank you. Okay, so what will happen next with permission from the committee, and I really appreciate that. Thank you. Look forward to working with everyone on that. Then on the floor, we'll make a motion to switch those sponsorships. If there's a bill that folks are interested in working on as a committee bill later, we'll do the same process. We'll make sure everybody feels comfortable with it, and then we'll bring that motion before the committee. Okay, now that we've got that housekeeping item out of the way, thank you so much, Representative Ortiz. We just have the one agenda item today, House Bill 54, Invasive Species Management. And I am just going to give the briefest of introductions for this. And today we're really lucky to have some very talented and knowledgeable individuals joining us who've been doing great work across our state. And so the bulk of today's hearing is going to be the invited testimony because it really helps create the context for what the bill is going to do. And just my brief comments about House Bill 54 in introduction, what I would say is, you know, along the way, I feel like I've learned that the best legislation is drafted when you work with all of the interested stakeholders. And this bill really represents that. It's been drafted over 4 years, working with hundreds of Alaskans. You'll hear about the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership, have been in attendance at several of their meetings. One of my most fun legislative experiences was actually at the fall meeting in 2019 when we actually had a group work session on this draft bill, and there were over 100 people in attendance at that meeting, and everybody provided input. So it included scientists, float plane operators, people from the fishing industry, staff from DNR, Department of Fish and Game, folks from the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, folks that have tourism interests, and just, you know, everything in between. So it's very, very exciting that we finally have this work product to present to you today. And what we've learned through this process, there are many coming threats in Alaska, from the changing climate and water conditions. Arctic shipping is another possible threat for invasive species. You'll see a letter of support from the Cook Inlet RCAC that talks about ballast water and oil rigs. We also have the issue of our travelers. You might notice once you know, are kind of tuned into it, for example, at Crow Creek and Girdwood, when you go to walk up the trail, now there's a spot to clean off your shoes before you walk on the trail, because with the number of visitors, you know, they want you to not bring invasive species onto the trail. And the problem is, because they're invasive, they can often overwhelm and take over the habitat and you know, cause harm for our native species, particularly salmon, and that's a big concern for everyone. So the bill, just briefly, and we'll talk about it more, does a couple of things. It creates this Alaska Invasive Species Council. We had the director from the Washington Invasive Species Council here in Alaska in the fall of 2018 and presented at the Invasive Species Partnership meeting and described how effective their model had been in Washington to bring all the stakeholders together and really make sure everybody was well coordinated and being effective in the efforts, because they can so quickly overwhelm you. More importantly, it allows you to be more effective with your spending, and that's something that is of great concern right now as we sort of struggle to pay our bills and make sure things keep moving along. So creates the council, this multi-stakeholder group. I hope folks will look at the membership of that, put a lot of effort into that, and then it creates a list of the things that they will do. And I'm going to leave it at that today. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about the fiscal note in the coming meeting as well, so that we can transition into the presentations that will really provide the foundation of why this is so necessary. So I do want to also have the record reflect that Speaker Stutes has joined us. Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. And I think where we're going to start today is with Danielle Verna from the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership. And then we'll hear from Aaron Martin from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Lisa Kuhei, also from U.S. or with Alaska Invasive Species Partnership, then Tammy Davis from Department of Fish and Game, and Tom Talby. Thank you all so much for being here and being willing to present to us. We have the full remaining 51 minutes for this presentation, so as they're presenting, we'll certainly take questions from committee members.
Okay, thank you, Representative Tarr, and good morning, honorable members of the House Fisheries Committee. Thank you, Chair Tarr, for inviting us to speak with you all today. We really appreciate this chance to share information about the threats and the opportunities related to invasive species in Alaska. My name is Danielle Verna. I'm a research associate with Alaska Pacific University, joining you remotely today from Cordova. I'm currently on the board of directors of the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership, serving as secretary. Today I'd like to start out by sharing with you what the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership is and what we do. And then we'll hear from three of my fellow board members, Aaron, Lisa, and Tammy, on specific invasive species challenges facing Alaska right now and why we believe an Alaska Invasive Species Council will strengthen our ability to respond to invasive species in our state. The Alaska Invasive Species Partnership is an informal group of individuals from agencies and organizations statewide, and collectively we recognize the vulnerabilities within Alaska related to invasive species. Our goal is to foster statewide coordination, cooperation, and action to prevent the introduction of new invasive species to our state and to reduce the impacts of existing invasive species. To reach that goal, the partnership provides leadership and support to engage a variety of stakeholders, including the public, in addressing invasive species issues. And as I'm sure we can all appreciate, this is a very collaborative effort across land ownership, jurisdictions, and borders. Members of the partnership work on land, in freshwater, and marine systems throughout Alaska. They work on a variety of projects to manage our current invasive plants and animals, to monitor and survey for new arrivals, and to conduct research on known pathways of invasive species. Aaron will share examples of all of this today, including species of high concern and how they are likely to arrive in our state. While the partnership currently has broad representation, we are lacking key stakeholders, such as industry and additional Native organizations, that would improve our collaboration and a coordinated response across the vast and very dynamic landscape of Alaska. And this is increasingly prudent as our climate continues to change. Next slide, please, Thatcher. The partnership is led by an 11-member volunteer board of directors representing nonprofit, Native, academic, state, and federal entities. And you can see those members listed here on the slide. Board members serve 2-year terms and are elected at our annual workshop, which I'll share more about in a moment. On the next slide, the partnership is organized with several standing committees that focus on specific species or tasks as identified by the membership or the board of directors. Currently, those committees include Elodia, Northern Pike, Marine, Government Relations, Workshop Planning, and Outreach and Education. In addition, we have several ad hoc committees, and these committees are made up of members of the board and the general partnership, and we meet as needed to accomplish our committee work plans. And to the last slide, please. As I mentioned, one of our goals is to provide various platforms for sharing information. And to do that, we host an annual workshop each fall that draws up to 200 attendees. And that workshop rotates between Anchorage, Fairbanks, and a more remote community. This year in 2021, the workshop will be held in Anchorage, if at all possible, if not virtually, as we were able to do quite successfully in 2020. And we can provide more information on that as our planning unfolds. We host a monthly meeting on the first Wednesday of the month for all partnership members to share progress on their work and discuss committee updates. In addition to our website, we are active on social media, and we have a brand new Facebook page to engage with the public, where we share rapid updates, job opportunities, and other information to encourage continued awareness about invasive species issues in Alaska. We also promote Alaska Invasive Species Awareness Week each year in June. Membership with the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership is open to anyone interested in invasive species in Alaska, and anyone is welcome to join our listserv or to contact us via email for more information. So in closing, I will say again that the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership is an informal group, and we operate in a true Alaskan style. Right now, we're able to accomplish what we do because of the motivation of passionate volunteers throughout our state that are dedicated to keeping Alaska wild and free of invasive species. As Erin and Lisa will now share with you, that is quite a large task with limited resources, and we see opportunities for improvement and enhanced coordination, particularly because invasive species are a continually evolving and very active threat that require our vigilance. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Danielle. We really appreciate you being with us this morning. We have a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Danielle, for your comments this morning. In regards to the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership organization itself, you mentioned that that it includes the concern of invasive species on land as well. From your perspective, while this is a fisheries committee, so mainly concerned about water issues, I guess, from your perspective, is the big fight where resources are going to have to be directed in order to address immediate concerns in relationship to invasive species, is the big fight in water, or is the big fight on land, or is it 50-50? How would you assess that?
I'd say the threat is fairly equal across biomes, and also that the threats between terrestrial and aquatic biomes are very related. Alodia is a good example of that because it's a freshwater aquatic plant, but it's typically brought here by terrestrial vectors like boats that are transported behind vehicles. And even with some of our terrestrial invasive tree species, they can affect the invertebrate communities in streams, which in turn affects salmon. So there's really kind of a network and a very cohesive relationship between terrestrial and aquatic invasive species.
Thank you.
Speaker Seuss has a question.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So Alodia and Northern Pike kind of speak for themselves, but what falls under the marine category?
I'm glad you ask. That's my personal favorite project to work on. There, we're particularly concerned with European green crabs. We're also concerned with invasive tunicate species that can be brought to Alaska on aquaculture or mariculture gear. And there are also invasive algaes and macroalgae that can be brought to our marine environments as well through fouling on vessel hulls and also in ballast water from large commercial vessels and also from small recreational vessels.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Danielle. I hope you'll be able to stay with us the rest of the meeting. And Erin, welcome.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Thanks, Danielle, for the introduction. Just a refresher, I'm Aaron Martin. I work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Regional Invasive Species Program Coordinator, sitting in Anchorage, Alaska. So thanks, Thatcher. It looks like you got the presentation up. So the next slide. So just general, what's at stake from a AIS lens? So you'll hear the term AIS, aquatic invasive species, brought up a lot today, probably. Aquatic invasive species impact a host of different issues across the country. Locally, what's at stake? Our hydropower facilities could be impacted through things like quagga or zebra mussels, should they get here. Watercraft users, which is a huge percent of Alaskans, could be impacted through different AIS. Similarly, floatplanes, what we're seeing already with the Elodia as it's become more established and spread throughout South Central and Interior Alaska, impacting access to lake systems and river systems. And also, from a food security and industry side of things, all these different pieces that you guys help us have resources to protect are at stake. Next slide. In general, Alaska appreciates having not very many invasive species. Certainly, we're on the very far end of the number of aquatic invasive species. This illustration shows the distribution and density of terrestrial and aquatic plants throughout the state. The hotter the polygon, the more dense the infestations are, and the more diversity there are. When I think about and describe invasive species management, we want to keep things in the low end of density, low end of diversity, and low end of distribution to really help us all be able to eradicate new infestations more quickly. So, next slide. So expanding on that, in general, Alaska enjoys being kind of down in this further left end of the invasion curve, with circled in red here. Certainly on the freshwater and marine side of things, this is where we're at for the most part. There's probably a handful of things that are here and some additional things that have shown up, and the partnership has been able to jump on and eradicate to keep them from spreading throughout Alaska. The main thing to take away from this is things move up, as an invasive species becomes more established and moves up the invasion curve, the cost of dealing with it and getting it out goes out significantly, and the potential impact to the ecosystem and the economy goes up as well. So we want to keep things in this lower left end of the curve in the axis, central axis there. Next slide. So I'm going to start out with one species that many of you may have heard of in the news already. So around prevention efforts, one piece that we've been working to keep out of Alaska for a number of years now through statewide partnerships are quagga and zebra mussels. These organisms, once they get it, they're native to the Black Sea and Caspian Sea of Asia, Western Asia. And when they get established into water bodies like the Great Lakes or the lower Colorado River, they foul infrastructure. This is the central image there, shows a pipe that's been coated in zebra mussels. So water distribution facilities, Anchorage water utilities, our drinking water systems could be seriously impacted should these things show up. Similarly, recreational opportunities on our riverways and beaches could be significantly damaged through just the debris of these mussels. Great Lakes have experienced a lot of beach value depreciation because of zebra mussel and quagga mussel establishment. And then the effects on the food web. These things change food webs. The food that our juvenile salmon and trout rely on, these would be replacing some of those key prey species and impacting the productivity of our salmon and trout and other fish species throughout the state where they get established. Next slide. So as I mentioned, quagga and zebra mussels are primarily in the Midwest, where they got established in the Great Lakes and then moved through the shipping, commercial shipping industry up and down the Mississippi River Basin. They have since gotten established in the lower Colorado River and in some places in Southern California. Next slide. So to help contain frog and zebra mussels, state and federal and tribal entities have been working with marinas and all sorts of other different industry members to contain frog and zebra mussels to these known infested water bodies or waterways and protect areas that they are not. So this red awkward polygon in this image is the Columbia River Basin, which to date has not known to have any frog and zebra mussels established in there. All the little circles that are green, red, and white, those identify what are called watercraft inspection decontamination stations or WID stations that are used to inspect watercraft as they're being pulled out of water bodies that may have been infested with frog and zebra mussels. They're put out in strategic areas, critical control points along highway systems and interstate systems to get a better idea of where these ship boats are going, but also clean them should they need to be cleaned. Boom. Unfortunately, the network doesn't expand to Alaska. We've been working with the Department of Natural Resources, Customs and Border Protection, and getting technical and outreach guidance from Fish and Game to run a watercraft inspection station at the Offam Port of Entry the last few summers to understand the level of risk of watercraft bringing frog and zebra mussels to Alaska. Next slide. So that was driven by kind of the general curiosity of knowing that habitat suitability analysis, looking at current water conditions in Alaska, in the most part are pretty suitable for these types of animals to get established here. The hotter the color in this map, the more suitable the waters are. So this is some preliminary work that we are doing at the national level. To date, there's been two studies statewide to a limited degree to understand where quagga or zebra mussels may already be established. Luckily, none of them have been found, but we wanted to understand more. So next slide, please. So as I mentioned, 3 years ago, we started doing some work to understand the level of threat into Alaska. So we've been doing this watercraft inspection station as a pilot feasibility program. So far, we've inspected over 226 watercraft. What we've learned is that 70% of all these watercraft that are coming to Alaska in the summertime have not been inspected en route, and that 38% of them are coming from states with quagga or zebra mussels. And just to be specific, those are not necessarily coming from lakes or rivers with quagga or zebra mussels, but certainly the risk is real that a watercraft could make it to Alaska carrying these things. So far, we have not found any live mussels on these boats that we've inspected. It's been a great outreach tool. Unfortunately, in 2019, over the 4th of July, we had a watercraft, this sailboat in the image here, brought to us from the Great Lakes. Communication through Fish and Game and other state agencies and the Canadian government let us know that this boat was on the way. And unfortunately, when it got to us, it was covered in what appeared to be dead zebra mussels. So we worked with the boat owner to decontaminate the watercraft, which is high pressure rinse with 120-140 degree water to get everything off. The challenge is getting in, and these zebra mussels get into the ballast tanks and all the bilge pumps, and so it requires a lot of work. We'll be continuing to move forward with this project. We'll be operating this year again for an extended period of time, starting in May and going until August. And if anybody wants to come out and visit us, please let me know. Next slide, Patrick.
Aaron, just one moment. We have a question from Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Thank you.
Through the chair, so boat, I assume that means boat and trailer. I know that a lot of it is transmitted with trailers, so I just see boat here. I just was curious about the trailers.
Yeah, thank you for the clarification. We are looking at the boats and the trailers inside and outside, and we're looking for things beyond just quagga and zebra mussels. We're looking for bryophytes, simple plants, and things, aquatic plants, that may be sitting in a wet place that could be brought to us. I have an image here that will give you guys an idea of where these boats are coming from. A lot of these people are coming to Alaska in a very fast fashion. So thank you for the... Okay, next slide. Okay, so the next slide. So the pressing news about zebra mussels, as I said, we've been planning on prevention efforts to keep watercraft from bringing zebra mussels in. Last Wednesday, USGS received notification from State of Washington that zebra mussels had been found being on these moss balls being sold at pet stores across the country. So the service has been working extremely close with the state agencies, the pet industry, and other federal agencies to get an idea of how long this has been going on, how many of these items have been sold and distributed throughout. I can't thank DNR and Fish and Game enough for the collaboration that we've had over the last week on this topic. We have found zebra mussels in Alaska pet stores. All these moss balls have been collected. Huge credit to Tammy Davis with Fish and Game for reaching out to pretty much every pet store in the state of Alaska, asking them to pull these things off the shelf. So a lot of new things emerging on this. We're mobilizing on outreach. We're mobilizing on all of these things are going to be analyzed and are being looked at as evidence by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Office of Law Enforcement for a national case. So just a heads up on the level of risk and how these things could potentially show up. So, next slide, please.
Oh, pardon me, just one second. Aaron, we have a question from Representative Ortiz.
You bet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the zebra mussel issue, says here is one of the most destructive invasive species in all of North America. So, if it has a negative impact or is it invasive on all of North America, where did it originate? Where is its original natural habitat?
Yes, thank you. I'm proud to say that. Zebra mussels and quagga mussels are native to the Black Sea, Caspian Sea area of Eastern Europe. And unfortunately, these moss balls, majority of them are, these moss balls are from that same area. And so they were being imported into the United States. And unfortunately, these zebra mussels and potentially other organisms were carried in on them. So we're working with the importers and the pet distributors to make sure these are all pulled off the shelves and a new process for decontaminating these to reduce this from ever happening again.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Vance has a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I know that many of these moss balls are available to purchase online. Is there any efforts in regulation that would prevent them from being shipped into states through an online purchase?
Yeah, so the Fish and Wildlife Service nationally is working with places like Amazon and Etsy, all the national pet stores like Petco, PetSmart. They've all taken them off, they're no longer available through those, or should not be. And then the state of Alaska, I believe, is working on some quarantine prohibited species listings similar to what was done with Elodia and other similar aquatic invasive plants to make sure these cannot be sold in Alaska in the future. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's very timely. It's not the gift you want, but it was like, I can't believe this is in the news when we're going to have this conversation today. So
yeah.
Really underscores the threat.
Yeah. So next slide, Patrick. The next slide illustrates what we've found through the watercraft inspection project on where watercraft are coming from. The ones that are the orange states are the states that have quagga and zebra mussels and New Zealand mud snails, which is another snail that we're concerned about. So just emphasizing how connected Alaska is to infested water bodies. These things can move on boats. They can move on fishermen's fishing gear and waders and things like that. So we have a lot of jet set travelers and a lot of people. We are hearing reports of people flying to Florida to pick up a brand new boat and then driving directly back to Alaska in like 5 days. So the chance of something being brought from somewhere is very real. So next slide, please. So a topic that you guys have heard a lot about, hopefully the last few years, is Elodia. We've been working hard across the partnership to increase prevention efforts and eradicate the known infestations of Elodia. It's our first aquatic invasive plant. As I just mentioned, it's a now prohibited species. It was brought through the aquarium trade and dumped through different water bodies. It reduces habitat quality, makes a monoculture, so a lake or a river system, stream system, just becomes this dense mat of Elodia, and makes it so salmon can't spawn very effectively, makes it so other mammals and waterfowl can't move around freely, and it increases the sedimentation in these areas. It works like a giant pipe brush, and so it just catches all the sediment that naturally would be just drifting down. So it clogs the waterways, but also reduces the spawning habitat quality. Next slide, please. So we've had the fortune of having some economic risk analysis completed. Dr. Toby Shore recently completed his dissertation and several publications looking at the potential impact of Elodia, if it's not addressed, on commercial salmon fishery and charter floatplanes. His impact analysis identified that if Elodia were to continue to spread through Alaska, it could have almost $160 million impact on the commercial sockeye fishery alone. Elodia oftentimes likes to get into lake systems, and so recognizing sockeye utilizing lake systems was a major aspect of that. And just for comparison, I mentioned the Great Lakes and zebra mussels earlier. Toby and I analyzed this. In the Great Lakes, where they have a variety of aquatic invasive species that are established, if their assessment right now is $138 million impact to sport fishing, commercial fishing, and water use in total. So the impact that Elodia could have if it continues to spread far outweighs the potential impact that Great Lakes are experiencing for AIS, which the interesting piece is that the Great Lakes are used as the epitome of kind of a severely altered, infested lake system. Next slide, please. Known infested water bodies in Alaska are shown here. Ones that we've been able to eradicate infestations are seen with the X's through them. The story that I like to express here is that the capacity statewide is growing as we get more organized across the partnership and more agencies and partners become involved. We're finding Elodia in more places, but we're also showing high success in eradicating it where we do find it. And the great thing is that we're finding it in really small infestations now, instead of these massive whole lake infestations that are extremely costly. We're now finding them in single acreage, single digit acreage, which is much more cost effective and less impactful to the lake system or stream system.
Aaron, we have a question. Next. From Representative Price Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've followed different articles about eradication, and the slide is really helpful in laying it all out. And I was wondering, the entities who actually do the eradication, this slide indicates that Fish and Wildlife is one of those entities, and I recall that ADF&G has done a little bit too. But what's the universe of eradicators, if you will, in the state, and who's taken on the most responsibility for doing it in proportional terms?
It's the beauty of this Elodia effort. It's been all hands on deck, right? We've got the Fish and Wildlife Service from a financial and technical people's on the ground. We've got soil and water conservation districts providing huge leads, leadership on an interior and on the Kenai Peninsula. We certainly DNR, Fish and Game. Everybody's pulling their equal weight here. More resources are needed because we are finding Elodia in more places, and it's a super costly thing to look for, but also to eradicate. People like we've got industry like Cook Inlet Aquaculture and Toyone Tribal Conservation District, Manly. The village of Manly on the Tanana River, they're working with us on this. So it's been awesome to see everybody coming to the table on this, but we need more truth there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Noted that it sounds like all hands on deck, and it seems like maybe each eradication effort is a little bit ad hoc in terms of pulling together a constellation of stakeholders. Does Fish and Wildlife have a dedicated budget for invasive eradication?
We don't have a budget dedicated for eradication. We have a national, we get allocated funds from headquarters for a variety of different prevention activities, early detection, and rapid response. And we've been working really closely with partners throughout Alaska to help identify that. But yeah, we keep talking at the Department of Interior level that we need a, as a whole, we need a rapid response fund. And then similarly at the state level, the partnership is talking that we need a rapid response fund to be able to jump on these, because we take funding from one critical project to address a new infestation before it gets too much bigger. So that leaves us with less. We can't move forward on other really critical pieces because we're kind of being reactionary on this other side.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I could add, and I should have in the introduction, that the bill also creates a response fund. It doesn't fund it, but it has creation to kind of address the issue that he just brought up. And Aaron, could you just give an example of, you know, a year-by-year situation for Elodia? I know there are some examples where we knew it was there, we didn't get to it in the first year, and by the next year we went back and, you know, much more substantial problem.
Yeah, so Alexander Lake has been a good example of that, and we've had a lot of success in the last couple of years catching up, but just because of planning processes and not having all the partners that we could in play, and then some staffing turnover between multiple agencies, we had a project that was probably at the time a $90,000 eradication project per year for 3 years. We let that project slip for a year and a half or so across the partnership, and it amplified now, and it's a multi-million dollar eradication project, and it probably possibly led to infestation at Sucker Lake, which is a nearby lake system too. So that story is shared across Interior Alaska as well. So we find it. So the key message is, once we find one of these infestations, we need to get on it. Right now in Interior Alaska, we found three new infestations last year. One in Harding Lake, it's fairly small. It's only 40 acres out of an 800-acre lake. And now's the time to get on it, because if it becomes a whole lake infestation, it'll be a multi-million dollar project instead of a few hundred thousand dollars.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you for the questions. So just briefly, this illustration shows the suitability of Elodia habitat across Alaska. So the hotter the color, the more suitable the environment is for Elodia to become established. So that's a lot of the state, and that's just under kind of current environmental conditions. And the red increases looking into the future if models are correct and water systems will be warming up. So, next slide. This illustration is tied to Dr. Shore's analysis on that floodplain risk assessment that I mentioned earlier. This does a great job showing how connected Alaska is through the floodplain industry. This is from charter companies, from private pilots, from agency pilots. Again, the hotter the line, the color of the line, the more frequent that travel point is. So these vector analyses that you'll see here and then future and on the next topic help us really prioritize where prevention efforts should be focused, but also early detection efforts. So we've been working really closely to expand our efforts around Crystal Bay area, recognizing how much traffic there is from Anchorage and the Kenai over to areas in Wood-Tipchick and Togiak National Wildlife Refuge and other lake systems in Crystal Bay. All right. Next slide. So the last piece that I wanted to touch on, Daniel mentioned briefly, efforts around European green crabs. It's considered one of the worst marine invasive species in the world. It harms our native crustaceans by eating them and outcompeting them. It damages estuaries by eroding and digging into mud banks, so destabilizes those delicate environments that a lot of juvenile fish use from freshwater systems as they emerge, but also marine juveniles as they look for nearshore habitat in their early life stages. So they're native to Western Europe, as you can see in the blue there, and they've become established throughout the western coastline and are moving north. Next slide, please. So working with USGS, the industry, and a bunch of other partners, Fish and Wildlife Service did a risk analysis to understand how ships were moving and what level of risk was going on as far as introductions through human-mediated pathways. Again, the hotter the color or the hotter the area, the more frequent we use these areas are. As you guys can all fully appreciate, Dutch Harbor is one of the busiest ports in North America, and boats are coming directly from Southeast Asia, North Asia, and some of the most infested ports and bays in North America, like San Francisco Bay, Tacoma, Seattle area. Next slide. So what that relates to is these marine shipping pathways are bringing ballast water potentially, but also critters living on the hulls of the boats. And what you can see in this illustration is above the dashed line are Alaskan ports, and below it is where these boats are coming from. And the bigger the line, the more frequent those traffics are. So Alaska is hyper-connected to places that are highly infested for marine invaders. So, next slide. So my final takeaways are just that Alaska's way of life and the industries that we all appreciate and work to sustain are at risk from a variety of invasive species. The goal is for all of us to keep the distribution and density and diversity of those invasive species limited so we can have a chance to eradicate them before they become so hyper-established that it's unfeasible. And then essential to all of that is to solidify this foundation of the partnership that is existing now, to increase awareness and prevention about the issue through discussions with you all, but also the public and further with the industry, and then build on the organization and the capacity among this partnership. Each entity has one or two people fully dedicated to this, and as we mentioned earlier around the Rapid Response Fund, oftentimes we get pulled from one house fire to the other, and it's just not really a very sustainable way to operate in such an important topic that's going to become more and more real for us. So, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you. I'm happy to take on any more questions or pass the mic.
Thank you, Aaron, so much. I continue to be like just totally fascinated by the research and, you know, that what's demonstrated with that presentation about the threat in Alaska. And so thank you so much. In the interest of time, I think we better go straight to Lisa if we could. And then if you could stay on and we have, you know, time at the end, if folks are okay with that. Because we just have a couple more people that have some things they want to share with us, and that way we'll get to everyone today. Thank you. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, members of the House Fisheries Committee. My name is Lisa Ka'ahue, and I am the Special Projects Manager with the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association based in Kenai. I currently serve on the Board of Directors for the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership as their chair. I want to thank Danielle for describing the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership, as well as Aaron for describing the invasive species issues that we face and what is at stake for Alaska. I want to focus on HB 54 and why the partnership supports this important bill. The main pieces of the bill that I will address are the establishment of an Alaska Invasive Species Council and a Rapid Response Fund. We believe an Alaska Invasive Species Council is needed because, as you heard from Danielle, a partnership is informal and dependent upon volunteers to push forward with invasive species initiatives. Although we have been successful, frankly, there's only so much we can do to move forward with invasive species issues, and we cannot compel agencies and stakeholders to participate. As proposed in HB 54, an advisory council to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that is comprised of members from state, federal, local, regional, and tribal governments, NGOs, and industry would provide a venue for regular communication. This will result in consistent statewide priorities, efficient management approaches, and common messaging to prevent the introduction and spread of invasive species in Alaska. A council may seem like just another level of bureaucracy, but it will ensure resources, especially state funds and resources, are being used in a coordinated fashion across governmental agencies and departments. The council will break organizational silos that are inherent when organizations have their own missions combined with limited resources. The proposed council in HB 54 is based upon successful councils in other states. A good example is the Washington Invasive Species Council, which Rep. Tarr mentioned in her introductory comments. Erin presented a number of potentially devastating invasive species issues we are facing. We need to stay proactive and be willing to create a broad council to ensure that our limited resources are used efficiently and with a high probability of success. If a council is established, the Alaska Invasive Species Partnership will do everything we can as volunteers to support the council. We will be a resource, offering our experience, such as input on strategic planning and providing issue-specific expertise. The partnership also supports the establishment of a rapid response fund, as outlined in the bill. This will allow the Department of Fish and Game to make appropriations to the fund in the future, as Rep. Tarr already described. Prevention truly is the best strategy for stopping harmful invasive species, but as Erin described, we can't always prevent the introductions. Having a rapid response fund increases the likelihood of successful eradication of invasive species so that we are not dealing with the multi-million dollar management problems later. Because of the industry I work in, aquaculture, I am partial to talking about salmon, and that's why I have exactly one slide for you, this one, that shows a northern pike from Alexander Creek with a belly full of salmon fry. Where you find invasive pike in South Central Alaska, you will find pike bellies full of salmon or whatever resident species are left over after the favored food of salmon has been consumed. Can you imagine South Central Alaska without salmon? Unfortunately, in some areas of South Central, these invasive pike have decimated once thriving salmon populations. This is just one example of why HB 54 is needed, but it is a critical example in a state that defines itself by its natural resources. Thank you for allowing us to speak today and for your consideration of HB 54.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Really great presentation. We have a question from Representative Chris Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the subject of pike, I saw it somewhere in the bill packet, the sort of differentiation between introduced an invasive pike and native pike, and I did not know this, that pike are native to a lot of Bristol Bay watersheds, and I'm wondering why, what it is about South Central watersheds that pike are so destructive, whereas there's seeming equilibrium in the ecosystem in Bristol Bay watersheds with salmon.
That's a great question, and I think Tammy is going to address that more in her presentation, but I will just say that from my understanding, the biggest reason is that pike and salmon were evolved together north of the Alaska Range, but when pike were introduced in South Central, it was a totally new alien species, and in areas where there are salmon, they did not evolve together, and so pike, being the predatory fish that it is, has managed to just really take over there. I'll let Tammy talk about that for presentation as well.
Thank you so much. And in the interest of time, I think we will just head into that presentation because she's going to talk about that. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you.
Tammy.
Good morning, honorable members of the House Fisheries Committee. I'd like to thank the chair, Representative Tarr, for the opportunity to provide this report from the Department of Fish and Game Invasive Species Program. I am Tammy Davis, the Invasive Species Program coordinator. Next slide, please. You'll hear me reiterate some of Erin's points as well as Lisa's and Danielle's. And while it may seem redundant, my hope is we will instill the grave threats invasive species pose to our great state, to our fisheries, our favorite ways of spending time outside and on the water, and even our means of transportation, and more to the economies that rely on healthy fisheries, clean water, and environmental resources. Next slide, please. So the definition of an invasive species is an organism that is introduced, a non-native organism that is introduced into an ecosystem where it can cause harm to the environment, to economies, and to human health. The Fish and Game Invasive Species Program strives for high caliber invasive species management based on the best available science and technology in order to protect, maintain, and improve the native fish, game, and aquatic plant resources of the state and the habitats where they live in the best interest of the economy and the well-being of all Alaskans. We're able to do this through collaboration with an array of valued partners, including the previous speakers. Here I provide a summary of invasive species management and control efforts we have accomplished over the years and continue to work on and invest in, most notably our strategic and successful eradication of northern pike in South Central. We have an outstanding team of biologists who are recognized for effective management and cutting-edge research. We support and seek to grow our community-based early detection monitoring work with citizen scientists and agency staff. Today, monitoring occurs in coastal areas for European green crab and fowling species, and we are gearing up to expand this model to freshwater to find what has yet to be detected in these waters and to prepare for what may be coming. Strong relationships have been established with stakeholders through direct communication and outreach, informing them about invasive species threats and how they can prevent their spread. Reporting and strategic planning are essential for success, and we are actively updating strategic plans. Next slide, please. This timeline provides perspective on the fact that in the past 11 years, the number and diversity of non-Indigenous species released into our waters have more than doubled compared to the past 40 years. We expect this to be a growing problem as humans are more mobile, transportation pathways expand, for example, more vessels and people into the Arctic, and more goods are distributed globally. These are the ways invasive species are spread to Alaska. Projects to eradicate invasive species infestations that originated from illegal release require expertise, collaboration with other agencies and landowners, reallocation of staff time and financial resources over years. Though costly, these projects are necessary to reduce the chance of further spread, to restore valuable habitats, and to reestablish or improve fishing opportunities. To efficiently use funds and avoid environmental and economic impacts, rapid response in preventing new introductions is crucial. Now I'll walk through some of the projects that Fish and Game has addressed for these infestations. Next slide, please. Northern pike. Northern pike were first released into the Yetna River drainage in the 1950s. Their drastic impacts on native fish have been widely publicized. And I know this committee, as well as others, have heard from the department about our success and projects over the years. Fish and Game is still hard at work to protect salmon fisheries in South Central. Response decisions differ within the region based on what is feasible for specific water bodies. Anchorage and Kenai Peninsula waters were prioritized for early eradication projects over the past 10 years because lakes are accessible and eradication was possible. The aquatic pesticide rotenone has been applied with positive results to eradicate pike from 23 water bodies. In addition to removing invasive fish, our team puts in as much effort and skill to ensure treated waters are restored and native fish species reestablished.
Next slide, please. Infestations in the Mat-Su are widespread, especially in the west side Susitna tributary drainages, like Alexander Creek, where salmon populations have been decimated. In this case, preventing new introductions, eradication where possible, and suppression using targeted gill netting is used to reduce pike populations and increase survival potential for juvenile salmonids. Research includes collaboration with universities and other federal agencies to prevent pike from moving into new waters and to understand pike movements and predation impacts, and to determine where populations originated. Next slide, please. Yellow perch were found in an unnamed lake on the Kenai Peninsula in 2000. They were the first fish introduced to Alaska waters that were not native to the state. So as Representative Chris Tompkins mentioned, northern pike are native to most of Alaska. However, they were introduced into the South Central region where they were not native. With the help from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, ADFNG used Rhodone to remove all yellow perch, and none have been found since that removal. Next slide, please. Didenogyx vexillum, or DVEX, is the common name for the invasive colonial sea squirt, was found in Whiting Harbor, Sitka, during the inaugural Marine Invasive Species BioBlitz in 2010. A team of agency staff, partners, and UAS students visited an oyster farm in Whiting Harbor because aquaculture is both negatively affected by invasive species, but also a common pathway for spread. We were shocked to find this oyster net and others encased with the invasive tunicate. The entire oyster farm was infested, as was the seabed in Whiting Harbor. Since 2010, Fish and Game has removed all infrastructure from the area. In collaboration with partners, we have engaged in novel research to evaluate the use of biocides to eliminate and control the tunicate, which remains established on the seafloor. With help from Division of Commercial Fisheries divers, Whiting Harbor will be surveyed again this year. Next slide, please.
And Tammy, pardon me for interrupting, because it's just hitting noon, we might start to lose folks. Apologies, but I'm going to stay, and I think a couple other people might be able to as well. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Muskellunge are in the same family as northern pike, and in 2018, during a pike eradication treatment on the Kenai Peninsula, 8 unusual-looking pike were recovered. A biologist thought to have the sample tested for species verification. Environmental DNA or eDNA research confirmed the species to be muskellunge or muskies, as you may have heard of them. Based on the age of the fish and anecdotal information, we believe the fish were released in 2012. The species could have dire impacts to salmon fisheries and stocked fish populations. Next slide. Some of you may have heard about this case also in 2018. A Sand Lake angler caught a fish that he couldn't identify. DNA again was used to identify the fish as a largemouth bass. Native to northern Midwest states and Canadian provinces, largemouth bass are voracious predators and have led to local extinction of several fish populations where they've been introduced. Next slide, please. Another surprise in 2018, fathead minnows were illegally introduced to a small water body on the Kenai Peninsula. The pond was drained and treated with Rhodonone in 2019. Fish were sampled by our fish and game pathologists and found to be carrying a parasite that could be harmful to native fish. Next slide, please. By now, you may have noticed 2018 was a big year for aquatic invasive species detections, and that kept department field staff on their toes. Goldfish were reported from Cuddy Pond, which is located in an urban park in Midtown Anchorage. Manual methods were initially thought to be an option to control the problem. However, they were not effective. The department received a DEC emergency exemption for a pesticide permit and applied Rhodonone to remove over 10,000 goldfish. Next slide, please. Last year, rainbow trout were illegally imported from a hatchery in Oregon and released. Unlike most illegal introductions, the release of rainbow trout into a Kenai water body
resulted in a law enforcement citation. This was a successful partnership between Fish and Game and Alaska Wildlife Troopers. Next slide, please. We're back to zebra mussels. Aaron's already covered this topic, so I won't belabor it, but we are facing a considerable threat from the species. The situation is eye-opening because the aquatic plant trade was not a pathway we expected to find zebra mussels. To shed light on the economic impacts of zebra mussels, according to the Pacific States Marine Fisheries, the estimated cost of failing to prevent an invasion of zebra mussels and quagga mussels, which is a similar species in the same family, into the Columbia River Basin, which includes waters located in the Pacific Northwest states and British Columbia, the cost exceeds $500 million. Currently, states in the region spend $13.2 million per year on prevention efforts, including watercraft inspections. Next slide, please. I'll close by just briefly mentioning that the department hosts online, smartphone, and telephonic options for reporting invasive species. And when an organism is reported for which Fish and Game does not have jurisdiction, we share that report with our identified partners. That's all I have this morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tammy. Any questions? Representative Christ Tompkins has a question.
Thank you. I'll just bundle two questions. Tammy, are you still the only employee at ADF&G exclusively dedicated to invasive species? Well, I'll just ask that one solo.
Yes, I am. We have staff in our Region 2 office who work primarily on northern pike. So, yes, with a caveat. We do have staff in our Region 2 office who are focused on northern pike.
Follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
And would you be able to speak to my previous question asked of Lisa about just why pike are so much more a malevolent ecosystem force in South Central relative to the rest of the state?
Thank you. Through the chair, Rep. Chris Tompkins. Lisa did talk about how salmon and northern pike evolved together where they are native. In addition to that, South Central has much shallower and slower moving systems and a lot of sidewater sloughs where vegetation is perfect for northern pike reproduction.
Last question.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Tammy, as you're going through the sort of roster of invasive species introduction events and subsequent cleanup, to what extent is the agency anecdotally or otherwise able to ascertain the source of introduction, like down to a person or a specific event?
Through the chair, that's a great question, Rep. Chris Tompkins. Because of new technology, particularly environmental DNA, and use of, let's just stick with technology. Fish can be tied back to home waters, you know. So, for example, we had an issue of the rainbow trout could be tied back to Oregon, and we have had issues with species introduced, and it was determined that the fish originated in the Midwest. So unfortunately, in that situation, we were unable to work with the troopers to follow through on any sort of citation, but it was clear that those fish were introduced from outside the state.
And just a last mm-hmm. comment. I mean, going forward, as the committee considers this legislation, I almost wonder if, and maybe this is for the chair or Thatcher, but I'd just be curious what criminal penalties exist for introduction of invasives, and if it makes sense as a part of this legislation to at least just be aware. I don't know what the laws mm-hmm. are, mm-hmm. and if there's more of a disincentive, because my like sort of sense is that people throw a fish in a lake because they think it'll be fun to go catch it, and they have no idea what massive public cost, taxpayer cost, is going to be incurred, not to mention environmental damage. And then the other thought, and this is just for the chair and the committee, is if there's a way to get some revenue in the bill, and I don't know what the mechanism is, but I mean, I personally would be very excited about, because this is just like a classic, you know, ounce of prevention is a pound of cure kind of situation.
Thank you, Representative Christ Hopkins. And there's some good news to report on that front. And we'll just, in the interest of time, if you don't mind, if I save it to the next meeting. Because was there a question over here? Did either of you have a question?
Thank you. My only question has to do with the council and also the department. I think our youth are so much a good part of educating their parents about invasive species, and every program that is introduced to children, they do pass on to their parents what they learned. What are the efforts of both the partnership that was talked about in the beginning and that the department does to do outreach to our younger kids? Thank you.
Thank you.
Through the chair, I'm sorry, I don't know who asked that question. This is Tammy with the department. I will, I can share our perspective. At least direct interaction with children occurs, especially in the Kachemak Bay area, where the Kachemak Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve does early detection monitoring with students. And that has also occurred in Sitka. One challenge for that, unfortunately, is kids are in school during, kids are out of school during the period in which most of the trapping events occur.
Aaron, did you want to add?
Yeah, thanks. To build on what Tammy said, another aspect of the partnership developed a communication strategy, and in that we identified key audiences, and certainly teachers, educators, and students were one of those main audiences. And there's efforts right now to develop educational toolkits to have for classroom distribution, but also in libraries and other visitor centers throughout the state. So that's a project underway right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did Lisa or Danielle want to add anything to that? Okay. Oh, I see him popping up.
Nothing.
Okay. Okay, well, it is 12:11 now, and I'm so appreciative that people were able to stay over. I'm so grateful to our speakers today, and Tammy, I know, really put something great together with not very much notice. Really excited that Aaron was able to finally present, because we've been trying to get this bill in front of a committee for a couple years now, and I think the timing actually is just right, though, with this go around. And so I'm just really grateful to everyone's great presentations today. It sounds like we'll definitely be following up with some questions, and we'll look forward to working with all of you as we consider HB 54. If there's no other business to come before the committee, we will adjourn at 12:11 p.m. and Thatcher will be sending out notes about what's happening next week.